Gary Nolan. I'd like to welcome you to the Progressive Commentary Hour. Today, the theme is a special look at the U.S.'s health care system, Obamacare specifically, and ask important questions. My panel, Dr. Michael Huntington from Corvallis, Oregon. He is a retired oncologist and a former medical director of the Radiation Oncology Department at Good Samaritan Hospital in Corvallis, Oregon. He is the founder of the Oregon Chapter Physicians for National Health Program that now has over 18,000 member physicians who favor single-payer universal health care coverage. His website, or that of the Physicians for the National Health Program, is pnhp.org. He is joined by Dr. Elizabeth Rosenthal from New York City. Dr. Rosenthal is a dermatologist and assistant clinical professor at Albert Einstein College of Medicine in New York City. She's an executive board member of the New York Metro Chapter of Physicians for a National Health Program, a very experienced advocate for single payer, until her retirement after 40 years in private practice. Dr. Rosenthal has focused her energies on the state of U.S. healthcare and argued for the rationale for a single-payer system. She is an advocate, and she is a researcher. She has led a delegation to Canada to compare the Canadian system with the United States. Dr. Rosenthal received her medical degree from New York University School of Medicine. Our final panelist from Southern California is Dr. Joanne Whitaker. He is a physician who has practiced for nearly 40 years. He has degrees from Dartmouth, Emory University School of Medicine, and completed his surgical studies at the University of California at San Francisco. He is the founder of the Whitaker Wellness Institute in Newport Beach, California, where he has served over 40,000 patients with his comprehensive protocols. He emphasizes prevention. Also, he is the author of several books, including Reversing Heart Disease. I'd like to welcome you all to our program. And I'd like to start with you, Dr. Elizabeth Rosenthal.
Yes?
I'm very concerned about the fact that there is not at this time, nor has there been, a really open debate by everyone who has something to offer about what's wrong with our healthcare system. Here's what's not being addressed in this current challenge. We are not debating the extremely high cost of medical care in the United States as compared to other developed countries. We don't ask, why does a surgical procedure cost 5 to 10 times more in the United States than elsewhere? Is it because you're getting 5 to 10 times better outcomes? We don't ask why, with all of the energy and money put into our healthcare system from the Surgeon General and the U.S. Public Health Service, the national agencies such as the FDA and the CDC, the National Institutes of Health, National Institutes of Mental Health, National Institutes of Allergy and Infectious Disease, why we don't emphasize prevention, which seems reasonable since it's a lot easier and less expensive to prevent a condition, if it can be, than to treat it afterwards. Why aren't we challenging the very high prices of many of our medicines? In fact, a group of 11 individuals in the American legislature lobbied extensively to pass the Medicare Act, and in it was a provision that no member of Congress had ever read. In fact, no member of Congress actually wrote this legislation, which is over 1,300 pages. I was told they received it the day of their vote, which was later that night. And in it, Medicare, Medicaid, and the VA could not opt for less expensive generic versions of a drug. They were forced to pay the highest prices. And then we had information, quality information, that showed that in some cases, the profit margin over a 30-day generic variety of the same drug was into the thousands of percents of margin of profit, which means the American taxpayer, over the lifetime of that law, will end up paying over $1 trillion in excess profits to the pharmaceutical industry. By the way, all 11 members who lobbied went to work immediately thereafter for the pharmaceutical industry, The highest paid was $2 million a year who went to work for the Pharmaceutical Advertising Council. And yet no one finds that unusual. The people in Congress don't know about the law, haven't read the law, did not write the law, and yet they're signing it as if they did. So then the question is, who wrote the law? Who writes any of our laws? And we're finding more often that special interest groups and lobbyists, with individuals who come from think tanks that are financially and ideologically and politically aligned, either liberal or conservative, but all benefiting special corporate interest. Well, that is also true with Obamacare, yet we don't ask, how is it that we are promoting and mandating a law that was written by principally the insurance industry, but also had input from the hospital associations, and yet those of us who advocate a different approach to health were not invited nor allowed our presentations an opportunity to challenge what we see as weaknesses. So that's what is not being addressed today. Then, before I ask you to address this, I want to show you the latest statistics, and this comes from the Institute of Medicine, the U.S. government's own official research body that looks at medical procedures and all things medical and tell us which are legitimate, which are not. They say 30 cents of every dollar is wasted with amounts to $750 billion annually. The breakdown is unnecessary services, $210 billion, insufficient delivery of care, $130 billion, excess administration cost, $190 billion, inflated prices, $105 billion, improper payments, $70 billion, and fraud, $75 billion. Dr. Joshua Solomon of Harvard School of Public Health found that the U.S. life expectancy for American males ranks 29th, 33 for females. When he compared this with other nations in the top 10, such as Japan, Singapore, Switzerland, Italy, France, and South Korea, he found that these countries encouraged preventative practices, such as advocating for healthy behavior and healthier diets, far better than the United States. And moreover, the U.S. health care costs over twice as much per person than the next highest country's health care model. And just a month ago, you wrote on this very important issue for the New York Times, and you reported that at present the highest earners in our healthcare system are not physicians who are providing the care and treatment to patients. The major dollars go to those involved in the business of medicine, insurance and hospital executives. And then the comparison of the average physician, $180,000 earned a year, the average surgeon, $300,000, but the average insurance CEO, $600,000, with exceptions being $1 million and one with a $36 million compensation package. So here is the issue. Take your time and compare the American healthcare system with that of other developed nations with healthier populations that are living longer lives and have a better quality of health at age 60, for example, than people reaching 60 in the United States. Please explain the economics and quality of care and delivery.
Okay. First of all, I have to correct a couple of things that you said. I am not the same Elizabeth Rosenthal that wrote the excellent series of articles about the cost of medical care in this country. She's a doctor who is an employee of the New York Times. She spells her first name Elizabeth with an S and I with a Z. So I would love to take credit for those articles, but I cannot. Also, you said that the VA is not allowed to negotiate with the pharmaceutical companies for lower prices, and in fact they do. Medicare doesn't and Medicaid doesn't, but the VA does. Anyway, all that you said about our system, or I like to call it non-system, is in fact true, and I think there are several reasons for that. When you say that why isn't anybody asking about that, why isn't anybody questioning that, I think people are questioning that. Certainly all members of PNHP are questioning that, but we don't get airtime. We don't get heard. When Obama said, I want to hear from everybody when he was making the law, we were not invited to the table until we threatened to picket the White House, loads of doctors in white coats. We just are not allowed at the table. Our voices are not heard, but there are many people who are asking those questions and are bringing up the very facts that you mentioned. The way our healthcare, I like to call it a non-system, is different from the others, from all other industrialized countries, is we are the only place that has a for-profit healthcare industry. people in this medical care, health care in this country is treated as a commodity to be bought and sold and upon which to make a profit, whereas in other countries it's treated as a right or a social need. In this country, you get the health care that you can afford, but in other countries you get the health care that you need. And I think the reason for this are many, but what's in the way, I think, of adopting what we all want, everybody on this call wants, which is a single-payer national health system, is the tremendously powerful, both economically and politically, of the health care and the medical industrial complex, which you already alluded to. And also, another thing in the way is that people are very woefully misinformed. They are not told about... They are on the misapprehension that in Canada and in Europe, people do not get the health care that they need, and that we have the best health care system in the world, and very powerful forces are continuing to keep them misinformed. One further obstacle, I think, in the way is that in this country we have the sort of pioneer mentality that everybody has to take care of themselves. I know that very often when I would speak to patients about my passion for a single-payer healthcare system, they would say, oh, why do I have to, why should my taxes go and pay for that man's healthcare? He's fat and he smokes. Why should I worry about him? And that kind of attitude. But mainly, it's the industry, it's the medical industrial complex in this country that is so terribly, economically and politically powerful. That is the biggest obstacle, I think.
I appreciate that. Let's go a little further on this with a follow-up. You're not happy with our existing healthcare system.
No.
Go through Obamacare and our otherwise the rest of our medical system and explain why you're concerned.
I'm concerned because in this country, many, many people are still one illness or one job loss away from financial ruin. Many, many, many people do not have access to good medical care simply because they can't afford it. And although there are some good things in the Obamacare law, more people will get access to health care, many, many people will be woefully underinsured. So they still will not really be able to afford medical care, especially if they get really sick and take a lot of expensive medications. Because fundamentally, nothing was changed. We still rely on our very inefficient, very expensive, totally inequitable system of for-profit health care in this country. That's what's causing the biggest increase in expense compared to other countries, and the legislation did nothing really to change that.
My final question at this time is that let's just take a look at the average cost comparisons for various procedures in the United States, and then the next highest nation. Now, I'm not going to the least expensive developed, just to give you an idea. Bypass surgery in the United States can go from $73,000 to $150,000. The Netherlands, $14,000. Routine office visit, United States, $176. Canada, $30. C-section, $15,000 to $26,000 in the United States, $6,000 in France. Hip replacement, $40,000 to $87,000 in the United States, $10,000 in France. Cost per hospital day, $4,000 to $12,000 in the United States, $850 in France, and they're not the least expensive. The drug Lipitor, $100 to $145 in the United States, $48 in France. Healthcare spending per gross domestic product, 17.6% in the United States, 9.5% in the average of the next 10 countries. And so if we were to remove the private insurance as the middle person in the healthcare equation, simply expand Medicare nationally, since we already have a universal plan within Medicare, how much might you expect our healthcare cost to be reduced so people wouldn't go bankrupt?
Well, you would have to have price controls. You would have to have some way, you know, you would have to have price controls on procedures and on different things. That's anathema in this country. And many, many physicians, hospitals, medical equipment makers, they charge what the traffic will bear. They charge whatever they want because they can.
All right. I appreciate that. Thank you for that input. Let's go. By the way, in New York City, there was an article last year showing that just sleeping for one night in a New York City hospital with no service whatsoever, no nurse care, no physician, no medications, no food, just spend the night in the hospital is $1,435. How in the world do you justify that?
I don't.
All right. Well, they do, and the moment you suggest that there should be cost containment, they scream. And yet for 10
right.
years, until the Great Recession, 2007 and 8, the number one or number two in any given year reason for bankruptcy was
right.
medical bills people
right.
couldn't pay.
Right. Well, yeah. Medicare is less expensive than other forms of health care. In other words, Medicare does put controls on what a doctor is allowed to charge. And all prices for medical care is going up all over the world and here too, but Medicare's prices are increasing less rapidly than that in the private sector.
I appreciate those insights. Please hold. Let's go over and say hello to Dr. Michael Huntington. Nice to have you with us today.
Hello, yes, I'm online.
Okay, I'd like for you to speak on what you're concerned about with Obamacare and how so many people within the Democratic movement and the liberal establishment have embraced it and refused to discuss its limitations or refused to discuss that Obamacare had nothing to do with Obama except he was responsible for being the public face of it. It was written. We have the logs of how many times there were meetings with the major health care companies, the insurance companies at the White House, the lobbyists, including former members of Congress that were brought in to lobby. They at one time had over 400 different people lobbying on this, but the payback to them is tremendous. Why isn't that discussed?
Well, there's quite a few reasons that I can think of. One is that getting reelected requires lots of money, and the most available money is from well-financed companies that want to achieve their own profit through creating legislation. And I think earlier you mentioned that the Affordable Care Act was actually written by a former executive from an insurance company who, after she helped write the law, went back to work for another insurance company. So I think legislators are reluctant to speak out and lose their funding that will get them reelected. So there's a major problem right there is campaign finance reforming that would make a difference. There's lots of reasons people are afraid to try something new. If we have had a system for 50 years, there's an inertia to not move away from it. We fear the devil we don't know more than the one we do know. So there's inertia. There's fear of government. And some of the problems in rolling out the Affordable Care Act have increased that fear of government. But that fear has also been fueled by corporations who don't want any government control of their profiteering. So I think there's quite a few reasons that we are not hearing a good, proper discussion of how to correct this problem. In the meantime, we're losing as many as 700,000 Americans per year because they have barriers to health care, whether it's money, but they can't afford health care, or they're in remote areas, they can't get to a doctor. And that could be corrected by a single-payer health care system.
All of us have seen at different times commercials on television for adults and children, mainly on Saturday mornings for children, that emphasized junk foods or high-fat, high-sugar foods. And I'm wondering how many Americans think, what is the likely outcome of a person becoming a high-scale consumer of that to their health? We now see that American children, per population are the fattest in the world, have the highest incidence of adult type 2 diabetes, are suffering from pro-inflammatory conditions, including arthritis, and even have, by the age of 16, advanced epithelium deterioration. In effect, they have a form of heart disease. And the Department of Defense said that 80% of all people that would try to get into the military today would fail because of they couldn't pass a very simple physical examination. So we're creating disease by our lifestyle, a high degree of disease that could be preventable. There's no emphasis upon prevention. And yet then I want to see, what is the association between the corporate sponsors, the media that allow those to go on the air, and the amount of money given to by lobbyists or other jobs, and it's astronomical. And that's why I don't see that there's anything that we seem to be preventing from getting into the media and hence influencing people except good information. Your thoughts?
Mm-hmm. Well, there's a number of thoughts that come to mind. One is that only 10% of our health, overall health, is related to the health care we get from doctors and clinics. And the rest of it comes from the very things that you're mentioning, our lifestyle, our environment, our education, our genes. All of those other factors are basically addressable by an adequate safety net of public health. And we don't have a system that adequately addresses public health overall. If we did, we would not allow factories to pollute the environment that cause illness. We would not allow the thing that you're mentioning about, the agri-industry of advertising the high-calorie foods that cause obesity. Other countries integrate their public health system with their overall economic system so that if one factor in their industry is causing illness, they see that that's going to cost the country too much, and then they have a very direct way of correcting the problem that's creating the illness. We don't have that yet in this country, partly because of our lack of control of corporations. So that's the way I see it.
Okay. Thank you for that insight. We are now told that most people's premiums on Obamacare will go up 25% in the near future. And since Obamacare went into effect, there have been over 37 significant changes made to it. And what we now know is that over half of those changes were made unilaterally by Obama without any legislative debate or action. And they completely bypassed normal regulatory processes. And all these changes are simply making the system worse. Have mm-hmm. you observed that our national health care system today is worse than what it was in the past on many levels, or do you believe that it's the same? What is your thought on this, please?
Well, I am happy that the Affordable Care Act passed. As incomplete and as flawed as it is, for a number of reasons, it for the first time people have had access to health care insurance, and I meet them in the streets, and they are so relieved that they now have at least access to health care insurance. And I think they will be benefited by it for a while. But what is not so clear is how good is that insurance? How good will it really be? And even though the Affordable Care Act, it prevents exclusion of people because of pre-existing illness, it has not stopped the insurance companies from restricting the kinds of services that they offer. So in essence, they have bypassed this restriction on excluding people from pre-existing conditions. If you don't offer HIV drugs, you're excluding that population. If you don't allow them to go to UCLA or Cedars of Sinai Hospital in Los Angeles, you're excluding many patients from the good care that they need. So in essence, some of these changes are undermining the very good parts of the Affordable Care Act that we need to stay on top of and prevent public pressure on the president and Congress.
Thank you for those insights. Please stay on hold. Let's go back to Dr. Rosenthal. Dr. Rosenthal, speak, please, on the power and influence of big pharma, big insurance, and big hospital, and their armies of lobbyists in Washington, and how much were they involved in the drafting and propagandizing of Obamacare? And then look at Obamacare right now. How have citizens benefited? To what degree? Compared to the corporate health giants?
Well, as you've already discussed and already outlined, the influence of Big Pharma was enormous. They spent millions of dollars lobbying to get what they did in the for the Medicare Part D drug program about how Medicare cannot negotiate for lower prices. I mean, and all of that was a very small amount to pay for the huge profits that that allowed them to get. And the rest of the industry was hugely powerful in writing the law. I mean, just as you've all said, they pay a tremendous amount to the legislators for their elections, and then their legislators do their bidding. I mean, without election finance reform, you really can't change that. And like was already said, the person who wrote the bill was somebody who used to work for the healthcare industry and is back there again. I mean, their power is enormous, and they were basically, President Obama went to them and said, "What do I have to do so you will allow me to pass this bill?" And he did. He did what they said. On the other hand, as Dr. Huntington said, I agree that it's better that it passed than if it didn't, because it has helped some people. It's just sad that it's so far off the mark from really changing the system, basically, as it needs to be changed. And still leaves millions of people without access to care.
A follow-up issue that I have not heard addressed and needs to be addressed is, should we have a policy for all of medicine, meaning nurses, doctors, hospitals, a no-fault medical policy that the individual doctor who is challenged with having engaged in malpractice is not sued individually? The compensation for whatever person can prove has been lost in wages or however the damage is done, and helping the person regain their health back, is the responsibility of the institution or individual that they have seen. Many have said that this would substantially reduce excessive testing, defensive medicine, where the doctor or hospital goes overboard on testing or procedures just so that the lawyer says, do everything, so they cannot show that somehow you missed it, bypassed it. And that has conservatively cost an additional $150 billion a year, just that alone. And it also has put some physicians under enormous amount of stress that they can't pay their malpractice premiums easily, in some cases over $100,000 a year. I interviewed several physicians recently in Chicago at a medical conference with over 2,000 doctors, and that was one of their biggest concerns. And I heard this repeated all over the place. Why don't we have the same as we do with car? It doesn't matter who caused the wreck. You know, the individual won't be sued for that. Why couldn't we do the same thing in medicine and to get a lot of the excess litigation out and bring down the cost and excessive testing?
Well, I think that our current malpractice system doesn't serve anybody very well, because it doesn't really compensate most of the victims, and it costs doctors, you know, a tremendous amount of money. It's just not a very good system. So I think changing that system would help things, but it's not the biggest cost driver in our medical system. It's only a small one when you look at the entire system.
My final question in this area for you is, one of the big debates in this nation is whether health care is a human right or not. And although polls show that the majority of Americans are displeased with Obama's health policies, there's about a 50-50 split among citizens whether healthcare is a universal right or not. I spoke earlier today with Ralph Nader, and he spoke about polls that show the majority of Americans now are favoring a single-payer healthcare system. What is going to be required for us to get such a plan, and what are your thoughts to counter the argument that people say, well, healthcare is not a human right?
Well, I think it's, I like to call it a social need. I don't like to get into the legal mumbo-jumbo or whether it's a right or not. To me, it's a social need, like fire protection and police protection and education. So that's how I like to describe it.
Okay. What do you think we have to do to get to where you would like to see a universal coverage?
Well, I think we have to get the people in the country so convinced that that's the way to go that they have to convince their legislators that that's the way to go. Unfortunately, our legislators right now do not necessarily do the bidding of those who elected them. They often do the bidding of those who paid for their campaigns. So there's a tremendous amount of work that needs to be done in fixing our elective system, getting the money out of politics. I mean, there's just so much that we have to do. But as a physician in PNHP, I feel like my mission is to inform people, to let them know really how things are, how it really works, and to inform them that it doesn't have to be this way. I mean, all other industrialized countries do it better than we do. It's not a big mystery on how to do it. You know, we have to inform them, and so they'll see that there's a better way than what we're doing now.
I would agree. For both of you, there's a larger overriding issue here, and that is how much of our lives are controlled by forces that we don't see, individuals who we don't know their names. We don't even know the names of the companies that are behind all this. We don't know the think tanks and the expert witnesses that they send out to testify before legislative hearings. We don't know their affiliations. We don't know their conflicts of interest. In effect, we're trusting that a person who has been elected to office to represent our interest may or may not be doing so. And more often than not, when we see the different types of actions that are taken without thought, and certainly without us being concerned, you look at America today, it's got 18 million children who are food insecure. They're going to bed each day without adequate nutrition because they just don't afford it. And then you have 145 million Americans who are living just at, above, or below the poverty line, sometimes working a couple of jobs. And there's this whole myth that somehow if you're poor, you're lazy and not trying to work. In point of fact, the vast majority of people who are poor are working at minimal wage or near it, and are not able to support themselves and their families and their needs. So a lot of them will say, well, how can we be healthy? How can we do yoga? How can we go exercise? How can we go for a run? How can we go to the health food store or farmer's market or get some fresh food for our family? We can't even make ends meet. We're living on, you know, credit cards. We're paying one credit card with another. So shouldn't we also be pulling back far enough to see the consequences to this? I just finished a major feature film called Poverty Inc. I've been filming it for over 6 years. Filmed and interviewed over 1,000 individuals for this at all walks of life. And one of the worst case scenarios, and this is rampant, it is not the exception, are senior citizens who had spent their whole life working and saving, who live within their means, but once the major corporate takeovers began and they lost their job, couldn't get the old job back or even the salary they were making, then many of them were paying for their kids' educations. And then, and even after the kid is long out of the school, they signed and therefore they're the legal responsible person. Then they don't have the job, they don't have the savings, they're burning through their savings. One day they end up losing their home or having to live in one room or have to eat cat food because they couldn't afford regular food. I actually saw this. I filmed this. This is not a myth. And we're talking about not a few thousand or a few hundred thousand or a few million. We're talking about over 12 million senior citizens. Ask them how their health is. It's abysmal. ask them if they're depressed or happy. They look forward to waking up each day. And you'll see that we have a whole hidden part of our society that the media's not touching, Congress doesn't address. Our social systems have failed at addressing. We have a lot of people hurting in the United States. And we have no attention to it, nor do we seem to have any interest. I'm concerned about this. I'm concerned when I'm walking up Broadway at 70, just a month ago, I'm walking up Broadway at 70, at 73rd and Broadway, there's a very famous store. It's called Fairway. It's one of the largest fruit and vegetable and produce stores in the United States. And it's 1 o'clock in the morning. And as I walk by, I notice a frail woman, but sitting on a little suitcase. So I stop and I went over and I asked her how she got there and where she was going to spend the evening. She said across the street at the subway station because I can sit in there, at least it's safe. And I said, you look like you haven't eaten. She said, well, I eat what I can. That's why I come here, so I can get some smoothies and food. She's 80 years of age. And I said, what's your background? And she said, I'm a physician. I said, you're a medical doctor? Yes. Retired, but yes, I'm a medical doctor. And I was a professor also of psychiatry. So I called a friend and got her a place to stay for the night. And what was of interest is her suitcase was meticulously packed, my friend said. And she was very conscientious of herself. But who would have thought, that a professor of medicine would be homeless sitting on a street? Well, that's my reality. That's the world I live in. I'm sorry, but by God, there's a time when we get real. Get out of our academic heads for a moment and look at the reality of what we have. We have a sea of suffering, and I don't see it being addressed on any level. Shouldn't we also pull back and see what happens to a person's state of mind, their health, their body, their biochemistry, when they can't even have a place to stay or food to eat in a given day, and that's not being touched upon in any meaningful way by the mainstream media? Would both of you address this, please?
Well, I see people, one of my volunteer jobs in my retirement is counseling people about Medicare in different libraries around Westchester. And I see seniors all the time who have to choose between paying for food or paying for heat or paying for their medicine because they certainly can't afford all three. And these are people, like you said, who worked all their lives. And now they're retired and, living on Social Security. And if they didn't earn very much, they'd get very little of that. And they can't afford anything. I agree with you, and I agree that it's not being addressed. It's disgraceful. It's a moral issue. I mean, all of these things that we're discussing are really moral issues. I mean, to me, a wealthy country should be able to take care of all these people and should be able to provide everybody with health care. And the fact that they don't is a crime and a disgrace.
I appreciate those insights, Dr. Rosenthal. Dr. Huntington, your thoughts on this, please.
Yes, well, I think we need to know these statistics that you, Elizabeth and Gary, you mentioned, and be sure that we have them firmly in our mind and update ourselves, and then not expect that telling people these awful statistics are going to make any difference. What we do need, with the strength of these very convincing statistics of how people are suffering, is to tell their story like you are doing, Gary. You're documenting on video what's happening, and then make sure many of us see that story. We're doing that here in Oregon. We have a stories project where we interview people who have suffered under the healthcare system, and they are very compelling stories. People, small business people who are trapped in their poverty, basically induced by their healthcare system, or unable to move from a dead-end job into being an entrepreneur because that they're stuck in this job getting their healthcare. So many issues. We're gathering those stories. We're putting them on our website, which is healthcareforalloregon.org. And then we will collate these stories by zip code and legislative district, so that our legislators will see that these are their constituents suffering like this. And then when the lobbyists come from the insurance companies, they can say, thank you for that donation, but I have this stack of these numbers of people, my constituents, who are suffering, and I'm afraid I need to vote for a single-payer health care system, something that will give the best care for the most people at the least cost. And that's we have to get to people through their amygdalas and their pancreases with these stories. We cannot depend on using these very compelling statistics.
I would agree with that. I'll give you one more statistic. And I have documented this in three award-winning documentaries on the veterans' health. And give you one example. I had heard that there were some very hard living, meaning they were at the bottom end of their life, living down near Titusville, Florida. That's over near Cape Canaveral. So I went there and with my camera crew, and I was taken into what looked like a normal suburban area, middle-class suburban area, and then there was a piece of property that had not been developed. I'm guessing it was maybe 3 acres. And into the woods we went, and there at 10 o'clock in the morning, we came upon a little tiny encampments, one tent in one area, four or five tents in another area. All the people were asleep, and it was boiling hot. And in one pup tent, there was, and this is a kid's pup tent, not an adult's, there were three males sleeping, but the top part of their body from their waist up was in the tent. The bottom, their legs were on the outside, mosquito bites all over. And there was one gentleman who had was in a little tent, and he had his clothes folded neatly and his shoes neat, and everything was very meticulous. And he was awake, and I began to talk with him, asked could I interview him. And I said, you have blood on your shirt. And he lifted his T-shirt, and he said, yes. He said, I just had some cardiac surgery and had some heart stents put in here 2 weeks ago. I said, but look, you have a massive infection. You should get some antibiotics immediately. And he took out of his hand a crumpled little piece of paper and he handed it to me. I opened it up and it was a prescription from the hospital. And I said, well, why didn't you fill it? He said, I only have about $6, and that's $76. I don't have it. I said, did you try to get it? And he said, yes, but no one here has any money. And then he told me this story, that every morning all these vets walk 4 miles to an employment office, and you have to sign in every day. And if you're a vet, no, they're not going to take you. Now, the contractors want to take the vets because they heard that they're all alcoholic or using drugs or violent, which is not true. Some certainly are, but not the majority. And he said, then we have to walk back here. He said, you know, if it weren't for the daily bread, we go there to get a shower and get a free meal each day. He said, but there's nothing else we can do. And I said, what about the VA? No, everyone here has been to the VA. They don't help you. What about all the people that called you heroes? Why don't you contact Bill O'Reilly and these people? If they're really your advocates, they'll support you. Oh, been a lot of communication. Nothing gets done. But then he said this. He said, we're a tiny little group here. He said, about 10 miles from now, here, there are thousands. And sure enough, in the woods, there are 16,000. Let me repeat that number. 16,000 homeless vets living in one area of Florida. We filmed them, and all of them have different health problems. None of their health problems are being addressed. So I filmed all this and did a documentary called American Veterans Forgotten and Betrayed. And the stories, there's just one horror story after another, including in Orlando. If you're a church group, and I actually filmed the church saying this, that on Sundays, if you are a regular parishioner, you can come and get the free meal they give. But if you're a homeless person, you can get arrested, because the people don't want the homeless around them. Hard to imagine, but that's also true in many other cities. So here we have, now, what is the number, total number? Over 900,000 homeless vets in the United States. How many are suffering from Gulf War Syndrome, post-traumatic stress disorder? Over 1 million. And these are the ones who are not being helped. If there was single payer, then they wouldn't have to wait for the VA, because they can't prove their conditions frequently are combat related. In fact, that's why they all said we get rejected. Unless we can show, like having an arm blown off or something, where you end up in a VA rehab center, they dismiss everyone, and there was a 16-month waiting list just to get an appointment. And people were dying, but there they, forgotten Americans. Your thoughts, please.
Well, I agree with the numbers. That sound very, very possible, and that the Veterans Administration has tried to do what it can with its funding to take care of the vets' outpatient problems that have occurred since their service time. And their inability to meet quotas has led to some of this gaming and backlog. But I want to make sure everybody knows that the system that the veterans has is something that we should be modeling throughout the country, in that once you do get into the system, and if it's adequately funded, you are much more likely to get better care, primary care, control of diabetes, hypertension. You may have to wait for a knee replacement or a back surgery if it's considered a elective type of a procedure. But they do get better care when the facilities are adequately funded. Their system is a good one. So I want to make sure people understand that it's not the system that's bad. It's underfunding and gaming that has been generated by trying to meet quotas that are unmeetable because of inadequate funding and, in some cases, inadequate monitoring of the gaming. So I'm glad you're doing this filming. We all need to see it. One thing I want to make sure everybody understands also, back to the malpractice, the best type of malpractice system is one in which everyone is guaranteed care from birth to death. One of the major motivators for someone to sue is because after a bad outcome, they don't know how they're going to pay for future health care costs. If people know that they will get that care, they will be far less motivated to sue. I want to make sure that's understood.
That's a valid point, and I thank you for raising that. You've been listening to Dr. Michael Huntington from Corvallis, Oregon, and from New York City, Dr. Elizabeth Rosenthal. Now let's go over and say hello to Dr. Julian Whitaker from Southern California. Nice to have you with us today.
Nice to be with you, Gary. Nice to hear your voice.
Would you take us through one of the biggest issues in our healthcare system? We could be preventing many illnesses or making an impact on many illnesses if we brought the best information we have from qualified independent studies and those clinicians who are at the forefront of helping their patients, who have deep experience, and just say, all right, we're spending all this money, we're wasting a lot of money, and we're not looking at the nature of these illnesses, what we could do to impact them with positive lifestyle. Could you take us through the illnesses that you've seen a difference that we could be saving people's lives, saving suffering, and saving people from going bankrupt?
Well, there are two major diseases that are truly treacherous in America, and that is type 2 diabetes and cardiovascular disease. And for the last 30 years, I've been treating type 2 diabetes by stopping all pills the moment I see them and stopping insulin the moment I see them. Don't confuse type 2 diabetes with type 1. With cardiovascular disease, I have seen tens of thousands of heart patients. A large percentage of them have been told to have bypass. I've only agreed one time, and that was with a patient of mine who had chest pain, and we were unable to reduce the pain, so we recommended surgery. But we followed him after his original diagnosis for 15 years. And in that time, there was a development of a non-pump bypass procedure on the East Coast, and he was on the West Coast, and he went and got that, and he's doing fine. But the real problem is we keep looking to government to fix the problem by saying you got to spend more money, when that capacity is exactly the problem. Here's a interesting little anecdote. The average hip replacement in the United States of America costs $40,364. In Spain, the same hip replacement costs $7,371. That means you can literally fly to Spain, live in Madrid for 2 years, learn Spanish, run with the bulls, get trampled, get your hip replacement again, and fly home for less than the cost of the original hip replacement in the United States. The cost that we pay has nothing to do with our unwillingness to pay it. The cost which we pay is simply scandalous, and it's dishonest and destructive. We, you know, our government, the FDA, just the whole process of the government taking over all of the payment for health care has meant that the government allows the health care professionals to charge whatever they want. And there is no way to fix it by using the problem to fix it, which is the problem. And that is an overwhelming control and willingness of both physicians and pharmaceutical companies and hospitals to take all the money they can because the government is paying for it. You know, the process right now is you go into a hospital, you go see a physician, and you've got a costly thing. They don't even tell you how much it costs. You can't find out how much your insurance is going to be billed for. You never see an accounting for it. But if it's anything like hip replacement, it's going to be 10 times what you could get it done in another country that has comparable and good health care. So I think that it's always very, let's see, what shall we say, it's very heart-strungy to say, let's all have health care. Okay, fine. That's a good idea. Well, the healthcare movement progressed greatly back in the 50s, 60s, and 70s, and early 80s. Now it has become an enrichment for lobbyists, an enrichment for doctors, an enrichment, and a big enrichment for hospitals. And you know something, Gary? It's not going to ever get better. It's just going to get further and further away from the rest of the world that have comparable and excellent medical care. That's my opinion.
Okay, we've just spent the better part of an hour, 46 minutes before you came on, discussing what my guest, Dr. Elizabeth Rosenthal, who's on the line now. She is a 40-year practicing physician and also a clinical professor at Albert Einstein College of Medicine, New York, who believes in universal health care that would bring down the prices tremendously because you take out the middleman, the insurance industry, and its so-called administrative overhead, which is about 30 to 33% of all of medicine is for them, and they include everything. That administration includes their private jets. It includes all of their promotion, the lobbyist.
What you're saying is that there's excessive expenditure everywhere you look.
Everywhere.
Everywhere.
Yeah,
and
how
in the world are you going to take the very people that are allowing the excessive expenditure to go right under their noses and turn them into good guys? You see, look, I know we have your guests and I see the problem. We understand the problem. We understand that we can't continue to go this way. All I'm saying is that to use the mechanism of the problem to solve the problem, in my opinion, it's just an opinion, is not going to work. Now, she may have a different opinion. I hadn't had a chance to listen to the other part of the show. But my opinion is there has to be an overhaul in the mechanism. I think the insurance companies would do a better job than government, because at least the insurance companies have a competition with other insurance companies. You see, if you eliminate the aspect of payment, which would be the insurance companies, then you're going to have the government.
Well, there is another way of looking at it. Those same insurance companies are constantly manipulating the market by price fixing.
Absolutely.
Three of the largest settlements in the history of the United States until recently, till the Wall Street bailout, were insurance companies paying hundreds of millions of dollars for damages in these lawsuits by the U.S. government, and it didn't affect their profit at all. So I would not like to see the insurance companies engaged. I believe if you eliminated them, you'd be saving at least 33%. Then if you controlled the cost, if you established an independent board that would review what does it actually cost, what it should be, where there's a legitimate profit to the physicians, because quite frankly, I think $150,000 average income per year for a physician is too little based upon all that that physician had to entail in the way of expenses and time sacrificed to become a physician, and doesn't begin to compete in the marketplace. And yet, when you take a look at some specialties making a tremendous amount, other specialties making barely enough to survive, in some cases, doctors are retiring. I don't want to see a good doctor retire from medicine because a malpractice insurance eating as much as $100,000 a year of their income, and the fear of litigation or being hamstrung every place they turn of what's going to be covered and what's not covered. The good people are leaving medicine in a high percentage. But if you had it so where you reform the entire industry, everything about healthcare you reform so that you bring it on a scale model similar to France or Canada or ones that are not bankrupting the system, providing universal health care, then I think that you're able to deal with this. But you got to take the profit motive out. And as long as there's a profit motive, there's going to be people controlling the system as they did with this one. I appreciate you giving us those insight. I just want this audience to know that Julian Whitaker has probably treated more people with diabetes and heart disease and got them well than any other doctor I know. And so he speaks with deep experience and commitment. We're out of time. His website is whitakerwellness.com. And I'd like to also thank Dr. Elizabeth Rosenthal for being on and Dr. Michael Huntington. I'm Gary Nall. This is the Progressive Commentary Hour.